I'm going to talk to you about how I got involved in this kind of work, and then I'm going to talk to you about my study called Judging Innocence, which looks at the cases of the first 200 people exonerated by post-conviction DNA. And then I'm going to talk to you about two additional projects which are coming out of that study. So I'm going to talk about a bunch of different things. I have some slides with numbers on them. I never would have thought I would have slides with numbers. And finally, at the end, I will ask that if any of you want to help me on this work, I have lots of research assistants, and the work is really interesting, and there's a lot of it, because just more and more questions keep getting raised by these cases. The DNA has led to the creation of a new kind of civil rights movement around the issues and causes that contributed to these wrongful convictions. And through the use of post-conviction DNA testing, we can find out, years later, that someone who was innocent was convicted. And so a movement has grown around trying to find these people, trying to use DNA to secure their release. And then people like me are trying to figure out, how in the world this happened, and how can we explain these cases, and what can we learn, how can we prevent them from happening again. I got into this work. I was clerking and trying to figure out what kind of civil rights firm I wanted to work at. And it was a ways into my clerkship, and I really had no plans to work anywhere. And then I heard about an opportunity to work at a small civil rights firm which had just been formed called Cochran, Neufeld, and Scheck. And this is a firm that Johnny Cochran formed with Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld because they got along together, basically, working on the Abner Louima case, this police brutality case, very high-profile police brutality case in New York City. My interest was in doing police brutality work. And so I figured, they were doing excellent work in these high-profile police brutality cases. That would be a great place to work. And I interviewed there. I worked there. And I even told them when I started working there, I'm not so interested in these Innocence Project cases, these wrongful conviction suits where you're suing police and prosecutors who were responsible for an innocent person being sent to prison. I kind of said, the other lawyer, there are only two of us who are associates there. I was like, you can give those cases to the other lawyer. I'm more interested in working on the police shootings and the brutality cases, because that's what I always thought I wanted to do, is do regular Section 1983 litigation. But there are a lot of these wrongful conviction cases to go around, and I ended up working on quite a few of them. And it ended up really enjoying those cases, in part because of the really interesting issues about the science and the criminal justice system and looking back and seeing what happened at these trials. Once I started teaching habeas and teaching criminal appeals, I started thinking back on some of my clients and what happened during their criminal appeals. Because these are all people who are convicted of serious crimes, usually sexual assaults. And I'll show you some of my data in a few minutes. But the reason why they're mostly convicted of sexual assaults is because those are the cases where there's a lot of DNA evidence that identifies the attacker. Because usually, in these cases at least, some kind of a rape kit was preserved, and so we have these swabs which they can make slides of, and they can identify that, yes, there was sperm deposited by the attacker. And so you can do DNA testing later on. Most murder cases, for example, also very serious criminal cases, the most serious, there isn't that kind of DNA evidence left by the perpetrator, except in the unusual case where the gunman's sweaty bandana is left at the scene or something like that, or if it's a rape murder. Anyway, so, in these serious criminal cases, people usually file appeals. They have time to file appeals. If someone gets out after 2 years, they may not have time to go through all of the regular criminal appeals. And I remembered from my clients' cases that they lost all of their appeals. Otherwise, they wouldn't have needed DNA testing later on. But still, there's a peculiar irony looking back at these appeals where the person is innocent. And it's not typical that you can look back on judicial decisions and know that in certain respects court got it wrong. There isn't that kind of certainty normally. You may think that a verdict was wrong because witnesses came forward later and it actually didn't happen that way. Or, there may be a videotape which shows that an incident wasn't quite what the jury thought. But with these DNA cases, you can be pretty definitive about identity in this band of sexual assault cases. And so you look back at these cases, one of the things that I noticed when I was working on them, I happened to have two clients where courts said during their appeals The appeals lack merit. Even if the Constitution was violated, there was overwhelming evidence of their guilt. And that struck me at the time, because I knew, so one of them was a guy named Hector Gonzalez. And there was definitely not overwhelming evidence of his guilt. I mean, everyone knows that these kind of harmless error inquiries that courts engage in are somewhat malleable. But still, it's hard to push Hector Gonzalez's case into the overwhelming category. And this is a case which actually the attack occurred not far from where I lived in Brooklyn, just, you know, like 10 blocks away. And there was like a melee outside of a club in the mid-90s. And apparently this was like a Latin Kings incident. And everyone was screaming, Latin Kings, and get the black guy. And so the Hispanic crowd surrounds, you know, a black patron at this club on 4th Avenue in Brooklyn, kind of a deserted avenue, which had this one club and basically just warehouses. And the victim was, you know, stabbed by multiple people. Like a mob of people jumped on him, knives out. The people who were attacking him were stabbing each other by mistake. There was lots of blood everywhere. And it was a really gruesome event. And police show up and everyone runs in every direction. And somehow later that evening, Hector Gonzalez, who is borderline mentally retarded, kind of, you meet him right away, he's just kind of a quiet, sweet person. He shows up at the hospital because he was at this bar for the first time with his cousin, who in fact was a Latin King, and his cousin was taken to the hospital for injuries. He's visiting his cousin at the hospital, and someone at the hospital notices that there's some drops of something on his jeans. They take it to be blood, and they arrest him. And, you know, there were witnesses who said, Hector Gonzalez, I saw him with a knife. And there were witnesses who said, I never saw him at the bar the whole night. And there were witnesses who said he was standing off to the side. Turns out later he was standing off to the side, just kind of looking. That's all the evidence that there was. The blood testing on his genes was, you know, inconclusive. And this is 1997. There's no reason they couldn't have done DNA testing. No reason at all. But the defense lawyer didn't ask for it. Apparently didn't think of it. And, you know, it was a public defender. And just didn't occur to them to ask for blood testing. This weekend, Friday, I met for the first time the medical examiner, the head of the medical examiner's office in New York at the time. And he said, oh, of course, our policy at the time would be that we would always do DNA testing because it was available. And I was like, well, how about in the instance where the prosecutor only asks for conventional serology testing and they don't ask for DNA? He's like, well, it doesn't matter what they ask for. We're supposed to do DNA. We had it in 1997. Well, for whatever reason, they didn't do it. And so at trial, all that comes out is, you know, the blood type matches the general blood type of the victim. Could be, you know, 40% of the population, something like that. And so he's convicted. And on appeal, where he raises claims about the reliability of the witnesses and things like that, courts say overwhelming evidence of his guilt. And then later on, the FBI is doing a Latin Kings investigation into some other people who are implicated in this attack. You know, there's a group of defendants. Trial is pretty short for each individual defendant. They're all tried as a group. And so, you know, the actual testimony at trial that related to Hector Gonzalez wasn't very long. The jury convicted everyone. But they're talking to these Latin Kings later in prison, and the FBI is hearing from all of them, Hector Gonzalez, he wasn't even a Latin King. He had nothing to do with this. He was that sweet kid who was standing off at the side. And so they did the DNA testing, and it exonerated him. And case number two that I worked on, where they said overwhelming evidence of guilt, was the case of Yusef Salam, one of the kids involved in the Central Park jogger case. And he raised a claim saying, you know, I never confessed. There's no videotape of me confessing like there was with some of the other youths. And the police officer just wrote some report which had things in it that I never said. And besides, you shouldn't have been interviewing me at all because my parents were there and they wanted to see me. And I was trying to assert my rights to get out of there. My parents, you know, the police claimed that they didn't realize he was a juvenile because he'd written 18 on his like school ID to try to, you know, pretend like he was older to his friends. They said they were confused by that. But anyway, another decision where they said overwhelming evidence of guilt. And so I thought of doing this study 2 years ago. Based on my experience, you know, representing these guys and looking at what happened during their appeals, I wanted to see whether in the aggregate, amongst the cases of all 200 people exonerated by post-conviction DNA, what would those appeals look like? And, you know, how would judges judge innocence during those appeals? Or would it even come up? Would these people even assert their innocence? You know, Hector Gonzalez and Youssef Salam, the two clients that I just mentioned, neither of them brought innocence claims. You know, they knew they were innocent, presumably. And I've talked to them since, and they said, yes, you know, we were telling everyone we were innocent. They told their lawyers, they told their friends, they told their family. But they never brought a legal claim asserting their innocence, and there's no judicial decision during their appeals ruling on their innocence. Instead, their judicial decision saying, denying these unrelated procedural claims, saying there's overwhelming evidence of guilt. So I wanted to see what these cases look like as a group, you know, having some experience with some individual cases. And the timing turned out to be fortuitous, because just when I was sort of wrapping up all the work, collecting information from these cases, you know, with the help of research assistants going back in each case to see what all the decisions said, what claims were brought, what rulings courts delivered at each stage, it was right around the time when we're approaching exoneration number 200. And Jerry Miller was exonerated. He was the 200th exonerated by post-conviction DNA testing in May. So that was a good time to end the study. End on a round number, make the math easier. You know, I'm not a social scientist. I don't have a deep knowledge of, you know, doing regressions or statistics. And it turned out no complicated was math to do this study. You know, most of my statistics involve simple percentages. How many of the 200 brought this kind of a claim? How many of the 200 brought that kind of a claim? And even just with basically counting, you can tell a really interesting story about these cases. So I want to show you just a little bit of the information that I put together in this study. And then I want to talk to you about sort of some of the implications of this study. And I'm going to start with some information about race. So here's my little slideshow. First of all, DNA. As Stephen Colbert says, Mr. Twisty. So this is the DNA molecule. I don't want to talk to you about molecular biology. I don't really know it either. But basically what you need to know what I'm doing and understand how this project works, DNA doesn't start to be used in cases involving crimes. You know, it isn't used forensically until the late 1980s. And obviously the double helix, Watson and Crick, all that happened some time ago. But the innovation that permitted the use in criminal cases was this technique of differential extraction, where basically they use a kind of a detergent to break down epithelial skin cells. And basically that sort of destroys any skin cells from the victim, because most of these cases are rape cases, and there's a mixed sample involving both epithelial cells and fluids from the victim, and some much smaller amount of semen from the attacker, if the attacker did ejaculate. And so sperm cells, apparently, who knew, have unusually thick cell walls. And so with this light detergent that they use, basically they can isolate the sperm and find the genetic profile of the perpetrator. And so this technique was developed in the late 1980s, used to separate mixed samples. They then sort of develop a way of locating parts of the chromosome. You know, it's all of these acetamine or whatever these enzymes are, these different nucleotides, are in all sorts of different patterns. They have been mapping the genome, and what they discover in the late 1980s is that junk DNA, you know, they're big parts of the double helix of the chromosomes that weren't thought to do anything. So everyone thought that this was just sort of junk, and it was sort of a mystery among scientists. What is all this extra stuff which doesn't seem to code for any traits do? Well, one thing they found was that junk DNA is really interesting. Still not sure what it does, but there are these parts of the chromosome which have these repeats. And it sort of seems like, you know, misfires, but it's kind of random. And there'll be these little patterns of, you know, AC, AC, ACE or whatever that'll just repeat. And some people have 3 repetitions, some people have 4 repetitions, some people have 5. People have different numbers of repetitions at these certain spots on the chromosome. And so that was the basis for using DNA to identify people, because the frequency of these kind of repeats are distributed pretty widely among the population. And so now we have population statistics, and so we can say thing at these 13 loci or different spots where these repeats occur, we can say things about how many people could possibly have, you know, four repeats here, five repeats there, six repeats there. And so that's where the science comes from. This is just sort of, just so you know, what modern testing looks like. It's run through a computer, and they generate these spikes based on what profile of repeats is at each loci. And anyway, so that's the short version of how the science works these days. What it means for these cases is that most of the cases I'm looking at are cases where people were tried and convicted before 1989. And so they were tried at a time when this technology wasn't available. And instead, there may have been other evidence that supported the conviction. And so one thing I wanted to do in the study is see what evidence supported the convictions. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But again, a lot of these are old cases. And so a lot of these people spent a lot of time in prison before this technology came along. What's also disturbing about these cases is that a lot of these people spent a lot of time in prison even after this technology came along. And so that's something I'll talk about in a minute too. So who are these 200 people? Here's some demographic information about them. 12 are juveniles, 12 are mentally retarded. Most of those juveniles and mentally retarded defendants falsely confessed. And so that's one interesting feature of these cases right there, that most of the false confessions in this group of people were made by people who are limited or susceptible to police coercion. It's almost all male. And again, part of the reason is that most of these are sexual assault cases. This is interesting in terms of the demographics. And I'd be interested to hear what your reaction is to this feature of the cases. So, 124 of these defendants out of the 200 were black, 17 Hispanic, one was Asian. And that's, if you just look at, most of those people were convicted of rape. And we have statistics from the Department of Justice on how many people are convicted of rape and what's the demographic breakdown of people convicted of rape throughout the U.S. You know, there's Bureau of Justice statistics, which are updated every couple of years. So among the sexual assault cases, 73% of innocent rape convicts in this group were black or Hispanic. Well, studies indicate that only 37% of all rape convicts are minorities. Now, that 37%, that's already, you know, disproportionate in terms of their minorities' representation in the population. So, you know, we already know that our criminal justice system has issues surrounding race and that disproportionate numbers of minorities are caught up in the criminal justice system. But what's really stark here is how much more of a disparity exists among these wrongly convicted people. And an important question in looking at these cases is, why is it that so many of these wrongly convicted people are minorities? So many more than you'd expect in a random group of rape and murder convicts. Now, there's one possible explanation. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts on it are. We'll get to in a minute the kinds of evidence that underlie these convictions. And like you'd expect in rape cases, the victim is around and typically sees the attacker. These are all stranger rape cases, meaning it's not an acquaintance. There are only a few acquaintance cases here, which raise different issues. But, you know, in most of these cases, the victim is going to make a complaint to the police, obviously, because they found out about it and there was a trial. And the victim is going to say, that's the person who assaulted me. And so almost all of these sexual assault cases involve an eyewitness identification by the victim. And the interesting thing is that the vast majority of these eyewitness identifications are cross-racial. And so it's a minority defendant and a white victim. Typically that way. There are some, I represented a client, James O'Donnell, who was white, and the victim was minority. But there are a lot of studies of error in eyewitness identifications, which suggest that error is more likely when it's a cross-racial identification, that people are more likely to make errors when they're selecting someone from a lineup and they're looking at people of a different race. So that may have something to do with why so many minorities are wrongly convicted and then exonerated by DNA. So that's one of many civil rights dimensions in these cases. Here's just geography. These cases are spread all around the country. And there are a few jurisdictions which have a lot of exonerations, but it's not necessarily because they have particularly terrible criminal justice systems. For example, Illinois and New York are at the top of the list for DNA, for post-conviction DNA exonerations. It may be because a lot of miscarriages has occurred there, but the main reason, I think, is that Illinois and New York were two of the earliest states to have statutes providing access to DNA, and Illinois and New York are the two states with the big innocence projects. The Innocence Project at Cardozo, that my former employers, Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld, founded, they were one of the early leaders in securing exonerations there in New York City. And Illinois has the second biggest innocence project, the Center for Wrongful Convictions. And so that may be the reason why there's so many exonerations there. It's because more people are looking, not necessarily because there are more innocent people behind bars in those states. So, point number one about these cases. These are mostly sexual assault cases. And the ones that aren't are mostly rape-murder cases, also involving a sexual assault. And that's just because those are the cases where there's relevant biological evidence which can show identity which was preserved. Almost all of these, again, are stranger sexual assaults. These aren't the typical criminal case. These are serious crimes. But these aren't even the typical sexual assault case, because most sexual assault cases involve acquaintances. Just of the ones that are reported and that, you know, that result in some kind of criminal action being taken. It may be that even more sexual assault cases are involve acquaintances and are not reported. But regardless, you know, less than a third of sexual assault cases involve strangers. These are almost all stranger rapes, where the victim misidentified the attacker. So, types of evidence supporting these convictions. Forensic evidence is highlighted because I'm going to talk about forensic evidence a little bit more in a minute. But most of these cases, like you'd expect, involve an eyewitness, usually the victim, who identified the attacker. A lot of these cases also involved forensic evidence, because even before DNA, there would typically be blood or hair left at the scene, and some expert would come in and say, you know, the defendant is an O-secretor, and the materials left in the rape kit, you know, seems to be from an O-secretor, and an O-secretor is, you know, 18% of the population, and so it could be a lot of other people, but it could be this defendant. Testimony like that. Typically in the murder cases, where there's no eyewitness, since the victim was killed, or, you know, in some murder cases there were people who weren't killed, obviously, you could have. But where the victim isn't around, a confession becomes much more important to the police. Almost all the confessions were in murder cases. Almost all of the informant testimony, usually jailhouse snitches, also in murder cases. The police are trying to build a case. They don't have forensic evidence. They don't have an eyewitness. How are they supposed to build a case? Well, a cooperative jailhouse informant happens to be in the cell next to this defendant and tells the police that, oh, I heard the guy confess. So there are a lot of informant and confession cases among the murders. So this part I thought you would think was interesting. So you'd expect, if you know you falsely confessed, you know exactly what happened. You were there. The police coerced you, or you just wanted to get out of the room. You just agreed with what they told you to say. Sure, I was there. Sure, I did it. You figure you'll clear it up later. Or you're one of these juveniles, or you're mentally retarded, or you're susceptible to agreeing to things that people tell you. And then after many hours, you get worn down, and you do what you're used to doing. You're cooperative. Or in another scenario, right, you were threatened. And then the police were really doing third-degree type stuff. And that's how your confession is secured. However it happened, you know you falsely confessed. Why wouldn't you bring a claim during your appeals saying, I falsely confessed, this confession was involuntary, reverse my conviction? So constitutional claims, only about half of these people brought constitutional claims challenging their confessions. It goes up higher to 65% if you include some kind of more roundabout way that they challenged their confession, saying, well, my lawyer was ineffective for not challenging the confession. And maybe that makes sense, that more people challenge the confessions because they knew what happened. They can include an affidavit saying what happened. All of them lost. So zero is the number in this group of people, these innocent people, we know now that their confessions were false. Maybe not coerced, but we know they were false. None of them got any relief. Courts are very reluctant to grant relief on confession claims because they know if the confession is gone, there's no way that the prosecutors are going to be able to secure a conviction. Right? What other evidence are the prosecutors going to rely on if the confession? And courts credit confessions. They think, you know, what kind of person would falsely confess? And we have a sense now of what kind of people will falsely confess. But courts find confessions quite probative. When you look at the other kinds of evidence, though, these jailhouse snitches, which I think anyone has some sense that these jailhouse informants aren't the most reliable source of information. You know, about a third of people challenged that informant testimony. We now know those informants were either wrong or lying. And in a few cases, the informant was actually the real perpetrator and had a very good reason to be cooperating with the police and fingering someone else. John Grisham has a wonderful nonfiction book, his first, called An Innocent Man, which came out last year. And that's a case where the main police cooperating witness was the actual perpetrator. Forensic evidence, hair and blood testimony. In a lot of these cases, and I'll talk about it in a second, there's just blatant scientific fraud right on the record at trial. Forget about making mistakes when you're doing the testing. Forget about testing where the technology just wasn't very reliable at the time. It wasn't DNA. These forensic examiners said things on in the trial record which everyone should have known at the time you were just not allowed to say. Blatant scientific misconduct. Hardly any of it challenged. Hardly anyone gets relief. Few people. 8%. And eyewitnesses. Eyewitnesses were the most common type of evidence supporting these convictions. Again, because these are all sexual assaults, the victim says that's the guy who did it. We know now that those eyewitnesses were wrong. Some of them, you know, anecdotally, we know that police misled these eyewitnesses and say, well, if you're not sure, you know, go with your first impression, go with number three. Or you might want to know that number three has a record a mile long of sexual assaults, things like that. In other cases, we don't know why it happened. You know, some of these victims have come forward and said the police misled me. But others are sure to this day that they identify the right person. Regardless, you know, less than half challenged. And, you know, less than a third brought the typical constitutional claims that one brings to challenge eyewitness identifications. And again, only a handful got any relief granted. So here's another interesting thing. You know, I teach habeas corpus. You think of habeas as being the place where constitutional violations are remedied. Hardly any of these people made it to habeas. They all filed their automatic direct appeal. A lot of them filed state habeas petitions. Most of them didn't make it that far. They gave up. They stopped filing appeals. You know, you might think that the innocent, well, they should be really aggressive during their appeals. They know they're innocent. They should be alleging their innocence at every turn. They should be filing every possible appeal. Most of them didn't. Instead, these cases look a lot like just the typical rape and murder appeal. And I put together a collection of typical rape and murder appeals selected the same state, same conviction, same year, to match these cases, so just to see, do these cases look like the regular criminal appeal or is there something special about them? And they look like the regular criminal appeal. They get more reversals than just run-of-the-mill criminal cases, but they get the exact same number of reversals as other rape and murder cases. And the same kind of evidence, confessions, eyewitnesses, in the same proportions, underlay their convictions, just like the run-of-the-mill rape and murder cases where we don't know whether they're innocent or not. And they allege their innocence, about the same amount as the typical rape and murder case. And so you know, they didn't do anything special. And judges didn't do anything special in these cases. They granted reversals the same as they would in any other kind of rape or murder case. And along the way, they said a lot about guilt. Almost half of these cases, the court referred to these appellants' guilt. A lot of the time, they said, oh, your constitutional rights might have been violated, but claim dismissed because of other evidence of guilt in the case. This error didn't affect the outcome. The outcome was reliable regardless of this error. So a lot of harmless error rulings. But my favorite of the ones, again, were they even cite to overwhelming evidence of guilt. It's just an overwhelming prosecution case. So a lot of references to guilt. Innocence, not so many reference, not so much reference to those. Some of these people did bring innocence claims, and none of them won. Brady claims aren't really innocence claims. That's sort of a, I don't want to get into that. The other disturbing thing, finally, the last kind of chapter in my study, was looking at how these people got DNA testing. And it was an uphill battle even once they realized DNA was available and could help them prove their innocence. The most amazing thing is that there's a series of cases, 12 of them out of the 200, where their decisions reflecting the fact that these people went to the court, here's the DNA, it excludes me, and the court said, well, we still think the eyewitness was reliable at trial. We don't know what this DNA stuff is, but relief denied. And the Fourth Circuit gets the award. The Fourth Circuit denied relief to 2 of the 12 in separate decisions saying, you know, let's put the DNA to one side. This conviction is obviously proper. The vast majority seek DNA testing through an innocence project. The vast majority of law enforcement consents, but there's still a significant number, the other 40%, where law enforcement did not consent and aggressively fought against DNA testing. In those cases, sometimes it's a court that ultimately orders DNA testing. Sometimes it's a state statute. But it's amazing the degree to which law enforcement often fights DNA testing, particularly where there's a great law enforcement benefit. Here you see that 37% of these 200 resulted in the inculpation of the real perpetrator, mostly through cold hits in these statewide and now nationwide, they're connected DNA databases. And some of those perpetrators have now been prosecuted. Some haven't. So one last thing I wanted to talk about. To the extent you think that, well, you know, these are 1980s cases. DNA wasn't available then, but it's available now, so our system can be more accurate. This is a problem that's disappearing. And the Times wrote, I was very fortunate to have great coverage of this study, the Times wrote an article expressing that same point. And Adam Liptak writes that, you know, there's a window of opportunity here to learn something about what causes false convictions, but that window is closing because now people get DNA at trial. And so there may still be false convictions, but it's not because of, you don't have this pool of cases where there's a new technology, the technology wasn't available at the time of trial. But what I think should disturb us is that in gray here, these are people who are convicted. These are the years that they were exonerated. And as the number of exonerations rise, the exoneration rate has been accelerating, there's still a lot of these gray cases, these dark gray cases. Those dark gray cases represent people who were convicted after 1990. DNA should have been available at their trial. Why wasn't it done? Why are there people who are still being exonerated by DNA in the DNA era? You know, maybe the window isn't closing as fast as it otherwise would. And I look through the reasons. A fair amount of the time is that DNA technology itself keeps changing and improving, which is good. This is less good. So in almost a quarter of these cases, the reason why they were exonerated even in the DNA era was that the state hid the fact that there was any biological material to test, or the state mischaracterized or misrepresented DNA testing that they did. And almost none of these people ever get forensic experts on their own. So they have to trust the state's word. They have no way of knowing whether the state actually did any DNA testing at all. All they get is the report. And if they're lucky, their lawyer, who probably knows nothing about the underlying science, may be able to do some kind of ineffective cross-examination of the state expert. Although actually, more and more state courts just let the state put in the report, not even put an expert on the stand, which is also disturbing. There's another amazing group of cases. To the extent that you hear people talking about a CSI effect, and oh, juries expect DNA evidence now, they expect forensic evidence, it's really hard on the prosecution because if the prosecution doesn't have DNA, they can't convict anymore. Here's one response to that. There's a big group of these people who did it, who were tried in the DNA era, and DNA testing was done, and it excluded them, and they were convicted anyway. And that's remarkable. The prosecution had to come up with, you know, some kind of convoluted theory to explain why the DNA didn't match. And they would come up with theories that, well, you know, the victim had a boyfriend. It could have been the boyfriend's profile. Well, you could do testing on the boyfriend to exclude. They didn't do that. Usually these people were only exonerated once there was happenstance, once there was a cold hit with another perpetrator in a DNA database. And wait a minute, that's not the boyfriend. You know, that's not. There's still a lot of these cases where the attorney doesn't request DNA testing. like the case of my client Hector Gonzalez, 1997. You'd think everyone knows about DNA by then. You know, my former employers had tried the O.J. Simpson case. Everyone, it's in the news. 1997, the defense attorney still doesn't know to request it. And the state doesn't want to do it because they're worried about what it would show. And so it just doesn't happen. So I thought those cases might be disturbing to you. And finally, one last project that I'm working on right now, which I would love to have help with. I just presented to the National Academy the other day these slides, which I really just finished preparing last week and getting ready for this presentation. And the Academy is doing a report, which is going to come out next summer, on the future of forensic science. And they're concerned that there are all these unregulated forensic sciences. You have these supposed experts who, you know, take a two-week course at the FBI and then hold themselves out as hair experts. And they'll come into the courtroom and say, these two hairs, I've never seen hairs more similar than this. It must be this defendant's hair that was left on the body or something like that. And hair comparison is not like DNA. There's no underlying probabilities. No one's done a study to figure out how many people have hair that is both dark and crinkly with, you know, reddish globules at the base. Like, no one knows. They're just looking at them and looking at them like you would look at, you know, handwriting or a footprint or anything else, saying these things look similar. And that's all they're supposed to say. And so what I did was to go back and look at these cases and see how much of the time did they depart from the science by claiming that there was a match, because that's one thing you're not allowed to say. You can't say there's a match. All you can say is that they're similar. And what I expected to see was this. Hair comparison isn't that reliable. These examiners came in and said, oh, the 20 characteristics, these hairs are similar. Turns out they were wrong. The DNA shows it. But they didn't do anything improper. They may have made mistakes. They may have been wrong that the hairs were similar. Or the hairs might have really been similar, but it turns out that you know, the real perpetrator had similar hair. People can have similar hair. So that's not what I found at all. In the majority of these cases, the hair examiner said stuff that was just beyond the pale. They talked about matches. Same thing, I was looking at blood cases. You know, blood serology, there really is science behind that. We really do know that, you know, 80% of the population is a secretor and 38% has type O and, you know, tiny percent has type AB, more have A, some have B. You know, those percentages are valid. I figured it's just that, you know, a lot of people arose. It could be the attacker was another O. There might not be anything wrong with the testimony. Turns out, the majority of the time, these forensic analysts said stuff that was beyond the pale again. And typically they did the same thing. It was the problem of masking. The victim would be an O, and the suspect would be an O, and they would say, and the secretions, you know, from the rape kit would be an O. And they would say, ah, the rape kit showed an O. The defendant's an O. It could be the same person. But what they're leaving out is that the victim is also an O. And most of the fluids in these rape kits come from the victim. It could just be the victim's profile. And if you have a victim who's an O, and an O secretor, and you have swabs that are O, the perpetrator could have been anyone in the world. Because you may not have picked up the perpetrator's profile at all. And they don't say that. Except sometimes they say it in other cases where it's helpful to them. But when it's not helpful to them, they don't mention it. And so we collected all these wild examples where, you know, people had been saying before the commission that, oh, there are a few bad apple forensic scientists who engaged in horrible misconduct. But they're few and far between. So we have cases just all over the country. And here's a list of all the different labs, all the different examiners. They're spread all over the place. There have been no investigations into hardly any of these labs, even though the examiner is engaged in blatant misconduct. And so that's one thing. This is just, you know, forensic evidence is just one little slice of what contributed to these wrongful convictions. But, you know, there's been an inquiry in Houston. There's an audit in Cleveland. The rest of these labs have continued to go about their business. Many of these people are supervisors at the labs by now. And they said grossly improper things. Here's my statistics. That's actually, right, here's the, you know, 57% of them had improper science. If you add to the mix things that were improper even aside from just the testimony, because, you know, this is just looking at testimony that on the face of the trial transcript, they said things that no examiner is allowed to say. This is adding to the picture where they hid evidence, they altered evidence, things like that. That may not come to light. Sometimes it did, and if you include that, it's more like 70%. So there's a lot of forensic fraud in these cases. And I love some of these examples. Here's one where they said, you're not allowed to say a match. So this person says, he goes even beyond that. He said, I was looking at the two hairs. They looked like one hair. It was almost like, they looked just like one. And it's like you just look on the floor, you see two $1 bills. It's obvious. Amazing testimony. And here's one. He says, well, there are two different kind of hairs. There's a head hair, and there's a pubic hair. And so what are the chances of both of those matching? You compound those, and the probabilities, I can't even give a figure, would be quite large. And he cites this discredited Canadian study. This one is amazing, too. Here this woman says, this defendant is white, and yet I could hardly mount the hair because it kept springing back. I couldn't even get it on the slide. And I've just never seen a Caucasoid hair which had this amazing characteristic. And the hairs of the crime scene had it, and the defendant has it, and you know, presumably, you know, she's using race in this way to say, you know, here's a white defendant, but he's acting like someone with mongoloid hair would act, you know, with these springy hairs. Identifying this phenomenon, which there's no studies on this, no one has ever, there's no evidence that this is unusual or typical, no one knows. This is all made up. Here's a great one, too, where he says, it's like rolling a dice. I would give a very conservative estimate, he said, that you know, one chance in 100 that a hair could actually match someone else's. But here you have two hairs. So it's like you're throwing two dice. It's like one in 10,000. And this guy Malakoff is infamous. He said this in all kinds of cases. There are many wrongful convictions attributed to him. And finally, here's an example of prosecutorial misconduct, where the expert is asked, so again, we're talking about they match in every respect. Is that correct? And the examiner is actually careful there. He says they're consistent. And later on, you know, he's also clear. You know, all I can say is the hairs are consistent. Their characteristics are similar. That's all we're allowed to say. Then in the closing, the prosecutor tells the jury, these hairs, more than one, more than two, more than three, and you heard the probabilities from his own expert. Pubic hair in that woman's crotch, matching Mr. Linscott. And here's someone who actually, this is one of the few cases where someone got a reversal. The appellate court actually understood this and how improper it is to say that something's a match, and gives him a reversal. And then after that, he gets DNA testing. Anyway, I have more examples of all kinds of blood fraud, and so there's a lot of work to do understanding what went wrong in these cases. Even just looking at this little slice of them, just at the forensic evidence, you know, these wild examples of improper behavior by forensic analysts, by prosecutors, defense lawyers that didn't do anything to cross-examine these people, and I'm looking at the confession cases too. There's a whole other universe of really interesting data about what happened. You know, what was said about these confessions? How did these confessions that we know are false end up leading to these wrongful convictions? So there's a lot more work to do, but I've at least sort of gotten a sense of what happened to these cases on appeal, and I'm starting to explore the particular causes that contributed to these wrongful convictions. And again, I think that there's going to be a lot of really interesting civil rights work that comes out of these cases as lawyers try to creatively push claims against these prosecutors and police departments that were responsible, try to get systemic reforms to try to prevent these miscarriages from occurring. You know, the Academy is going to push their report and push Congress to pass legislation to reform some of this junk science. And so I think this will be a really exciting area for people who are interested in civil rights and human rights. There'll be a lot of opportunities for all of you to get involved in this work if you're interested in doing it later on. And if you're interested in doing it now, I could certainly use the help. But anyway, we have a bunch of time left, and if you have questions, I'd love to answer them. Hi. Hey, Melanie.
What system, if any,